Yay, keep drinking your coffee.
Diet quality and how it affects your chance of dying.
If you have early prostate cancer, should you have a prostatectomy?
And addressing treatment-resistant depression.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on July 14th, 2017. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, of course, I have to turn right to Annals of Internal Medicine. As a coffee addict, I am so happy and grateful that my practice has been vindicated.
This just confirms your addiction. Did you have any idea that there were over 2.25 billion cups of coffee ingested each day? And that in the U.S. alone, 75% of adults drink coffee and 50% do it on a daily basis? And in fact, I've got some brewing in the other room right now. With that much coffee ingestion, it really is important for us to know the health effects. Now, previous reports have suggested that if you ingest coffee, whatever form, so that there's less than 400 milligrams of caffeine per day, it's healthy from a heart standpoint. What this study does is look at coffee ingestion, two large studies in different parts of the world, and looked at if it affects mortality or not. One was a European study conducted in 10 different countries of over 500,000 men and women. And by the way, the follow-up was 16 years in this study. The other study was a multi-ethnic cohort study. It followed over 185,000 African Americans, Native Hawaiians, Japanese Americans, and Latinos for an average of 16 years as well. And both showed an inverse relationship between coffee ingestion and mortality. People that drank 3 to 5 cups of coffee had about a 20% lower mortality over that 16-year follow-up. Large numbers of patients, long follow-up, different parts of the world. But again, this is just an association. It doesn't prove causality. There are plausible reasons why this may occur. Coffee has some antioxidants.
But no data in this particular study relative to other beverages that contain caffeine that people like to quaff. And I specifically cite things like green tea, for example, that we've reported on its health benefits.
You're right. This was just limited to coffee. And the other question is, well, does it matter whether it's caffeinated or decaffeinated? And there just didn't seem to be any difference between those two. By the way, it seemed to be true across all these different ethnic groups and across all 10 countries in Europe. So it does lend some credence.
Well, I would say at least given that huge sample and also the geography of the sample size, we can't advocate any particular type of coffee as being the best.
No, we can't. And in fact, we can't even say you ought to drink coffee for your health because we can't prove it. But what we can say, if you're drinking it, it doesn't appear to be harmful.
Well, that's good because I don't think I could get up in the morning and be remotely functional without it. And I'm going to keep doing it.
Not as early as we record, you can't.
Let's turn to the New England Journal of Medicine, this ongoing issue we were talking before we recorded about, wow, the things that we come back to again and again and again, and this is one of them. If you have early prostate cancer, should you undergo a prostatectomy, removal of the prostate gland?
This is a follow-up of a previous study looking at observation versus prostatectomy in people that had asymptomatic prostate cancer, found either because of a biopsy or because the PSA was abnormal. And in the original study, they found no significant difference in mortality between men who underwent surgery for localized prostate cancer versus those who were treated with just observation only. So this is during almost 20 years of follow-up, an average or a median of 13 years. And what they found was the same thing. After nearly 20 years of follow-up, again, among men with localized prostate cancer, surgery was not associated with a lower overall mortality or prostate cancer-related mortality. What it was associated with, however, was a higher incidence of side effects, primarily being urinary incontinence and sexual dysfunction. This suggests that for, again, local disease is that men have two options, and if presented with them, they can choose which one they prefer. Now, in fairness, the men that had surgery had a lower incidence of having progression of their disease. But the flip side is most of the progression still was asymptomatic and it was still localized, and men didn't die of it. This data arms the physician to present it to the patient, the individual, so they can decide what kind of therapy they want. But it shouldn't allow healthcare providers to recommend the more aggressive therapy and tell individuals you'll do better with it. That's not necessarily the case.
Well, okay, so that was pretty good, but I would go even further, and I would say that for me anyway, if someone came to me and said, wow, I've got localized prostate cancer, I would say, well, then under no circumstances undergo a prostatectomy, because your chances of developing a really troubling side effect are high, and you probably are not going to do any better than the guy who has more conservative therapy. So I would say that, but here's the question. What kinds of assessments are necessary in order to follow someone closely so that safety is in the front of this paradigm?
The two major ways, obviously, are doing PSA testing, and then oftentimes some type of imaging study as well. In these types of individuals, the chance of metastasis is pretty low. It's about 3%. The chance of dying of prostate cancer is pretty low as well. And I'd say that's even more so in the older patients, the patients over 70 or 80 years of age. And unfortunately, those are oftentimes the men that are subjected to the prostatectomy, suffer the consequences, and really don't receive any benefit at all.
That segues us very nicely, of course, because I'm going to suggest that one of the consequences of becoming incontinent or experiencing sexual dysfunction is depression. So let's switch over to the Journal of the American Medical Association. This is an important study, I think, because there are so many millions of people who have depression. Depression often is refractory to treatment. It just doesn't resolve with a single agent. And this study takes a look at, hey, what happens if we switch around or add another?
And in fact, less than one-third of patients that have a major depressive disorder achieve remission with the first antidepressant that they're put on. So in those two-thirds of individuals that really don't receive remission, what's the next step? You can imagine there might be several different options. One is to put people on a different antidepressant, a typical one in this particular study called bupropion or Wellbutrin. The second is, well, maybe you add that agent to the one that the person's already taking. Or the third option is to take one of the newer, what are called atypical antipsychotics, and add it to the first agent. And in fact, that's exactly what this study did. In a VA population of over 1,500 patients that did not achieve remission with the first antidepressant, they either switched them to bupropion, they either added bupropion, or they added an atypical antipsychotic called aripiprazole, otherwise known as Abilify. And what they discovered was that in this predominantly male population, because again, it was a VA study, augmentation with Abilify had better results, that is more remission or a better response rate than the other two, albeit it was modest. When you look at side effects, it appears that with Abilify, there was a higher incidence of somnolence, restlessness, and weight gain, a higher incidence of anxiety with bupropion, whether it was added or substituted. This puts us on a pathway to say, okay, of these three options, one is a little bit better, but all three do offer benefits. And again, you weigh the benefits versus the side effects.
Clearly, there are any number of agents out there for the treatment of depression. I'm wondering about this idea of adding an additional agent that works by a different mechanism of action or on different pathways in the brain as a strategy for trying to alleviate intractable depression.
And as you suggest, because of that, adding a second agent in a different pathway was in fact more beneficial than the other two types of therapy. But again, it was a modest benefit. An absolute 4 or 5% difference in terms of remission and in terms of response rate, which was in the mid-50s versus the low-60s. So again, targeting a second pathway is more beneficial. It wasn't a huge difference.
Further study, I think, because we certainly have a number of things on the table that could be tried both singly and in combination.
And in fact, there are 3 or 4 different atypical antipsychotics that have been approved by the FDA as augmenting the original one. So your point's well taken.
Well, let us return now to the New England Journal of Medicine and return again to something we seem to talk about an awful lot. That's diet. And I'm going to let you frame this up.
We've talked so much about diet, I almost started to yawn when this came across. But I think it's important because this talked about not a specific diet, but diet quality and how it affects total and cause-specific mortality. When I talk about diet quality, it acknowledges there are different types of healthy diets. We've talked about the Mediterranean diet, for example. There's a DASH diet from the American Heart Association. No matter which of these you adhere to, if you do a better job midlife of having a better quality diet, does it improve your overall survival? And what they discovered is that no matter which of these diets you adhere to, if you improved your quality by about 20%, it lowered your risk of death, depending upon the diet, from about 15 to 20%. What does that mean, improve your quality? Well, for example, for the alternate healthy eating index, if you have 1 cup of nuts or legumes, and if you're eating 1.5 servings of red meat and you cut that down considerably, it improves your mortality by about 20%. It didn't matter which of these diets, all you had to do was to improve the quality of diet.
And I'm going to counter that by saying, wow, yet one more factor that people are going to need to consider when they go to the grocery store. Is this something that could be accreted to the healthy diet index or not?
And there were some dietary factors that were kind of common between these. High in fruits and vegetables, high in whole grains as well. They differed with regard to antioxidants, but those things were common among all of them. If I told you that we could prescribe a medication that would lower your risk of dying by 20% and it cost you nothing, you'd say, well, gosh, I'd like to have two or three bottles of that and take it once or twice daily. And I'd say, well, this is within our control. Improving our quality of diet improves our quantity of life.
On that note, I'm going to talk, of course, about the coffee and mortality study on the blog this week. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.